the first thing I want to do is put everyone else on the spot. I'm interested in who you are and why you've decided to come to this breakout session. And the third thing, whether you have brought some audio to listen to. It's not required, but I'm just interested so that I can think about timing. What I want to ask everyone to do is to go to this microphone over here and just say your name, why, you know, just a few words about why you're interested in this session, and then did you bring an audio clip, and if so, what is it?
Hi, my name's Ray. I'm from CKUT 90.3 in Montreal, and we're starting a project called the Magic Soundbox, and we're just starting to get our ideas together for it, and I thought that this might lend itself as some inspiration.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Julie Shapiro with the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago, and I'm always up for a discussion about sound and story and place and radio. So.
I'm Justin Grotlish, and I just put out an audio art festival in the Boston, Massachusetts area called the Megapolis Festival, and I'm here with transom.org today blogging the festival, and I produce soundscapes in my spare time.
I'm Greta Cohn. I'm a freelancer from Brooklyn, New York. I'm here on the Air Stipend, representing Air, and I'm interested in hearing your thoughts.
Hi, I'm Sarah Yam. I'm an independent radio producer, also here on the Air Stipend, and I'm interested in the relationship between place and sound.
Hi, I'm Andrea Salenzi. I work at WNYC in New York, and I'm here blogging for Transom, and I want to share this great presentation with everyone.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone. That really gives me a better idea of why you're here and what your interests are. So my name is Andrew McCartney. I teach at Concordia University in Montreal. I've been teaching there for the last 10 years, and my area is called Sound in Media. I teach in a communication studies department, so my students do everything from radio work to film sound to music recording. It's really quite diverse. My own creative work has for the last almost 20 years focused on sound walks. So that is almost always the basis for the recording and creative projects that I do, is doing sound walks that are often repeated sound walks in the same location. Over sometimes several years in one project. I did repeated sound walks for 4 years in some locations along the Lachine Canal in Montreal. And so today I'm going to be talking about soundscape on radio. And so I'm really thinking here about different ways of working with environmental sounds in a radio context. And the traditional way that you will hear environmental sounds on radio is kind of like an establishing shot in film work. The environment is presented to give a context for what's going to come. And it's usually fairly brief, just a few seconds of ambient sound recorded in a location. And then there's a movement to the voice. And of course, on radio, the voice is predominant, and spoken word musical singing predominates on many radio shows. So part of working with soundscape on radio is finding a balance between the voice and the sounds of the environment. And there's always a temptation to have more and more of the voice because of the radio context. So I think it's important to leave time for sounds to develop and to be able to work on the listener in different ways. So there are a number of different roles that soundscape can take in a radio show. And what I've done is I'm going to go through those roles and then play some short clips from different soundscape pieces that I've done. And I'm going to be focusing particularly on pieces that I did for the CBC radio show Out Front. I've been involved with that program three times, and the shows really feel quite different to me in terms of what I was asked to do by the Out Front people, and in terms of how I was thinking through working with soundscape. They're all soundscape related, of course. So the first role that I want to talk about is the didactic role. And this is really, you'll hear a fair amount of soundscape work that has a didactic role, intending to introduce people to the idea of soundscape, to introduce people to listening practices, to encourage people to take part in their own kind of soundscape activities. And an example of this is a piece by Out Front called Shut Up and Listen. This was a piece that was not initiated by me at all. It was part of a series on Quebec audio artists. And I had been living in Montreal for a few years at that point and was right in the middle of the Lachine Canal project. So the producers came to Montreal. They met with me at my house, and we drove over to one of the locations where I do sound walks around the Lachine Canal, which is Lock 5. And Lock 5 is the place where the Lachine Canal meets the Lachine Harbour. So it's kind of the end of the Lachine Canal. And so it was a location that I had, at that point, I was going to on a monthly basis. And I would go at different times of day, trying to go in different weather conditions, different kind of traffic conditions. And then if there was anything special going on, or if I heard anything as I was... I lived in Lachine at the time, and if I was downtown in Lachine, which is close to this Lock 5, if I heard anything going on there, I would be drawn to finding out what it was. So the producers from Out Front took me to that location. It was raining, and the three of us did a sound walk together. The structure, and I'm not going to play this whole show for you because it's a 14-minute show and might take up a little bit too much time in the session. But the structure of the show was that they interviewed me about what sound walking is, or what my ideas about sound walking are. And then we did a sound walk together around Lock 5. And I talked about some of the other sound walks I'd done in that location. They played a piece that I had already made about that location. That was kind of inserted in so that we were moving from the live sound walk to the recorded piece. And then the host of the show went back to Toronto and designed and did his own sound walk in the Don Valley area. So they had all of these ways of kind of gradually bringing the listener into the practice of sound walking by showing them what it was like, and then the host kind of going through the experience of figuring out a good location to do his own sound walk and then doing it. So I thought that show really functioned very well as a didactic piece. Another example of a didactic piece like that would be Hildegard Westerkamp's Kitts Beach Sound Walk, where she talks at the beginning about Kitts Beach and the environment and the weather on that day. And then you move into a her thinking about the sounds and the kinds of imaginary soundscapes that she was interested in as a result of hearing those sounds. But there are many other examples of these kinds of didactic sound walks. Greg Wagstaff has also done these for the touring exhibition of sound environments in the UK. Now, related to that didactic role is making people aware of changes in the soundscape over time and how those changes relate to social and political changes in the culture. So, and this is really a big interest of mine. And the reason that I do these repeated sound walks, for instance, in the Lachine Canal area, over the 4 years that we were doing sound walks there, there were buildings that were taken down. And so we had recorded inside some of those buildings an ambience which no longer exists because the buildings were gone. The Lock 5 that I was recording, I happened to be there one day. It was chance. I happened to be there one day when there was really a very noisy and, as it turned out later, significant activity taking place. And I'll play you, it's a minute and a half, I'll play you this short piece called Lock 5. And it, and so I'll talk about it after I've finished. So that piece was just a set of cross-faded sections from a longer field recording. I was there probably 20 minutes and recorded during that time. But for the installation work that I was doing at that moment, I wanted to take short sections and crossfade them just so that people could get a sense of what had happened in that 20 minutes. And it was interesting that that was the final time, I didn't know that when I did the recording, but that was the final time that any bridge parts were loaded from that jetty to be transported away from Lachine. The company, Dominion Bridge, which had been in Lachine for decades, closed down shortly after that. The Lachine Canal was being opened for pleasure boat use, so there was very little industrial activity going on there at that point, but it was still there even though it was dwindling. And so It turned out to be a historically significant recording because it was the last time of loading, and so that very heavy infrasound, the low frequencies in that recording, just doesn't exist in that location anymore. But also the 300 jobs that were at Dominion Bridge still in Lachine also disappeared at that time. And so many of the recordings of the Lachine Canal project showed historical change. And so that's an example of the historical role of soundscape in radio. Another piece that I did for Outfront was more of the traditional Outfront approach, which was that I was thinking about an issue in my life that was personally significant, and that was something, even though it was something from my past, it still had a lot of resonance in the present. And this was also to do with sound walking in a kind of tangential way, because it focuses on walking. I didn't walk until I was 4 and a half, and this may explain part of my passion about sound walking, is that I always find walking to be miraculous. And so in this piece, there are particular sounds that have a lot of importance in the story. So I'm thinking here about the narrative role of soundscape in radio. And so I'm going to play you a couple of excerpts from this. And just look at my notes here. Okay, so I'm just going to skip to 2 minutes into the piece. So this piece is called Learning to Walk. I'll play you a short clip here. It's about 20 seconds.
The way that I'm walking all the time, I'm just going to walk all the way up the stairs, trying to keep that knee over my second toe.
So, what I'm working with there is just walking up the stairs. It's a very everyday activity, but the reason that I chose the stairs was that I lived in this house with very creaky stairs, and I thought that the creaks are a very good register of the effort and focus that I had about walking at that point in time, because I was being taught how to walk properly at the age of 48. I was being taught, you know, you put your knee over this toe, not that toe, and, you know, so I was very conscious of the physical act of walking, and I think that that really comes through in that sound of the stairs creaking. So then a little bit later in the piece, I'm going to play a longer clip here. It's about 3.5 minutes. And this is focusing on bells and the sound of hospital curtains, which were another two important sounds.
Why the bells in the background? And that's from a time before when I walked, a time when I was actually immobilized, when I was in hospital and had my legs in a cast from the age of 18 months until 4 years. I go to my mom, and she tells me about the hospital. They were going to manipulate your legs into position. The hip joint wasn't in the right place. And so we took you back to hospital, which was traumatic, because you didn't understand. You were just a little girl, less than 2 years old. And I could only visit you half an hour a day. Suddenly I'm back there in that bed. I can't move. Everything is white, cold, antiseptic, huge, metallic, empty, and full of pain. 6:30.
And as soon as you saw it, you started to cry. We used to come round with a school bell to alarm everybody, alarm it was that we had to go home, and as soon as you saw the bell, you started to scream. To give you the bell, and then we had to, creep away.
It's not it, right? But it's close to the one in the hospital.
Yes, this is not it. This is one that I got from a bell maker.
That's heavy.
It is.
Wasn't that heavy?
Yes.
So how were you holding it?
Well, I that's the one thing I remember. The only thing I remember of the experience was that it was really hard to do this.
Oh, I see.
It was really hard.
After the cast was removed, I was able to get outside. I was able to start playing with the other kids instead of watching them through the window. I started running and jumping and never looking back, never thinking about what had happened with my hip, trying to put that whole time out of my mind. I felt like I was normal, like everybody else, that my hip was the same as everybody else's hip, that I could do everything that everybody else could do. And this went on for years. And then finally, the pain returned again.
So I'll stop there. The bells for me had a number of different characters. And those characters were related to different aspects of the story. So, for instance, I took a bell sound and slowed it down and took away the onset of the sound so that it just was a kind of wash or a suspension. And that made me think of the anticipation of returning to the hospital, because it was a kind of regular once a month thing that I would go for several days. It has a musical function there, but also a narrative function in that I could repeat that at different points in the story to kind of stand in for that anticipation of returning to the hospital. I took a bell sound again, removed the onset, and turned it backwards, and that related to me for the idea of traumatic memory. So the suddenly being back in the hospital bed in my memory. The curtains meant a kind of lack of privacy, or the invasion of privacy that goes on a regular basis at the hospital. And so after I had used that the first time, again, I could bring it back into the story when I wanted to work on that emotional aspect of the story. The tolling of bells is kind of a reminder of what you have to do. And the church bells in the distance has, to me, always been a very comforting sound, so I associated that with the sound of my mother's voice. So I became quite conscious about the use of the bell sounds, even though I had been quite unconscious for many years about why bells were so important to me. And so I had quite a collection of bells during the making of this piece for Out Front. I became conscious about that collection. I wanted to find a school bell, for instance. I wanted to recreate the experience of playing the school bell that I had done as a child. So I ordered a school bell from Ohio and had it sent to me. Interestingly enough, I mean, I think bells in soundscape are a fascinating topic. Has anybody here heard the documentary The Bells of Europe? Which I think is a brilliant piece. And in that, the bells really do develop as a character. And so that was a real inspiration for what I was doing here. And the bell that I had got from Ohio, I talked to the maker on the phone, and he said, I said, you know, do you have much call for school bells these days? And he said, well, actually, yes, in the prison system in the United States. That's what, you know, and I thought, that really makes sense, that, you know, thinking about the links between these different institutions, hospitals, schools, prisons. So in that piece, I was really focusing much more on the narrative function of soundscape elements. Yes, for sure. And I just want to say to everyone, please feel free to ask me questions anytime. I love it.
I always wonder about this because you've revealed so much about your intentional sound design in the piece. And I think overall, as listeners, we get the effect. But I may not have understood each little detail that you were creating, so we would get the effect. So as a producer, how do you balance something you know you're doing because you're driven artistically to represent what you're trying to do and the message you want to give to the listeners? And how much do you think it matters whether we get all of that as long as overall we get the sense of what you're trying to do? And maybe does it not even matter because you're fulfilling what you want to do with the piece and we're still getting something from it, but maybe not exactly what you're delivering?
Thank you. I think I'm really happy when there's a wide range of different interpretations of a piece. So it doesn't really, and it doesn't really matter to me at all whether people understand that, you know, the curtains meant invasion of privacy to me. I mean, they could mean something. Some people may not even recognize that sound if they hadn't had a time in hospital in the same way. I did another piece that was based on walking from the end of my street to my house. And I did that for a year. Well, not every, I didn't record every time I did it, but I recorded about every 2 weeks. And that became part of a group show at the Art Institute of Chicago. And I included a booklet where for each piece that was part of the grouping, I asked people to write just pen and ink, you know, responses to what I had done. And I mean, people would make connections between sounds that they had heard that were similar but from different places, or feelings that they'd had that were different from what I had. I mean, they obviously wanted to engage in a conversation with the sound work, and there was a lot of difference in response, a lot of difference in interpretation. And I found that, I mean, just all of those differences and the kinds of conversations that started to go on between different listeners, I found that really fascinating. And much more satisfying than if everybody had gone, oh, yeah, right, that's, you know, that's obviously what she's trying to do, and had really just sort of interpreted it the same way that I do. So, yeah, I love that difference in interpretation from one person to another.
In that piece, you were using quite emphatic sounds, sounds that are clearly, I mean, bells, we know what they are, and curtains. Can you use something that's more, a sound that's more amorphous as a character that comes back again and again in a soundscape, or do you think it works better if you're using something that is really focused, you know, that's that kind of...
Well, I think... Yes, thank you. I think actually the suspension is an example of an amorphous sound. Like, that, when you take away the onset of the bell sound and you slow it down and it makes just this kind of... hum or it's just this long suspension. It's not clearly a bell. I mean, people wouldn't necessarily know that I had made it from a bell sound. If it's a clear... Well, I don't know. I think that amorphous suspension... I don't know. I mean, I that would be a question for other listeners, which works better. And I feel like amorphous sounds can work if they... or ambiguous sounds. And so I was also going to talk later on about different perspectives, you know, sort of like the long shot, medium shot, close up. And when you record a sound close up, often it's really ambiguous. You really can't tell exactly what it is, but it often has a very strong kind of feeling to it, or a touch, or it's not exactly an emotional response, but a kind of physical, sensual response that you'll have to a close-up recorded sound. And that can be very effective. So even though it's ambiguous and you're not sure what the source is, that sensation that the sound gives you can be something that you can work with in terms of character, I think.
I have two questions, one technical and one more theoretical. So first the technical question, mm-hmm. and I'm asking this because I'm doing a sound walk this summer.
Yeah.
I've been reading a lot about people using binaural microphones and mannequin heads to really recreate the sound of being in place, and I wanted to know what mics you used. Mm-hmm. That's the technical question.
Yep.
And then the theoretical question, the first piece seemed to be very much about a physical geography, and the second piece is really about an internal geography and a personal trauma. And I'm doing a sound walk this summer in Santa Cruz, California, which was leveled in 89 because of the earthquake. And the sound walk is actually really about it's a physical geography of memory. Mm. And so I guess my question is, you recreated personal memory in sound. How do you create a collective memory in sound? Or you talked about moving through a place and recording something and then coming back and it no longer being there. How do you record what's no longer there is my sort of larger theoretical question.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good question. That's, yeah. When I say that, I'm playing for time. I'm sort of thinking, whoa, that's a lot to think about. I think it's good to think about right here too. Collective memory. If we have time later on in the session, I could play part of a piece that's kind of. A late summary of the Lachine Canal project. And in that project, there was quite a bit of collective memory because I interviewed various people who had lived in Lachine or close to the canal for several decades. And they were able to tell me, I mean, I was interested in what did the canal sound like when it was actually functioning as an industrial canal, and they had some memories of that, and they would do interviews with me, and they would often imitate sounds, and then we would try to find the sounds either in archives or in another location. So we went to the Seaway on the other side of the St. Lawrence, and record those sounds and then juxtapose them with sections of the interviews where people were imitating the sounds and that kind of thing. And then there was somebody who talked about the history of the area. And then I read a book by Gabriel Roy called The Tin Flute, which was about Saint-Henri in the 30s, so a residential area close to the canal. And she had passages that talked about the soundscape from that time. So if you're trying to find out about what a soundscape was like in the past, I mean, talking to historians, talking to local residents, and finding a way of doing those things, trying to find the sounds elsewhere and juxtapose them, and to create a kind of imaginary link to what it may have sounded like in the past. And so I would think you would have access to some people there that you could talk to. And it's always a really interesting, and you find things that you don't find in history books when you're talking to people as well. So that's what I would recommend, is talking to people and then trying to find those sounds. Like, we went to the Canada Steamship, is that the name of the company? The Canada Steamship Lines, who had run ships in the canal in the past, and they actually had archives of ship's horns that had been recorded at that time. And then they also had a history of the company that we looked at for trying to find historical information, but not just printed sources. Really, people were the biggest source of inspiration. Thank you. Was there another part to your question that I didn't get to? No. Okay. Good. Because I had a feeling that. Oh, mics! I knew it. Yeah, I knew there was something. Yes, so at the time that I did the Lachine Canal recordings, I did have binaural microphones, but they were the kind that clip onto glasses or, you know, clip onto things. So it's not a dummy head kind of situation. And the interesting thing about the Lachine Canal, it was the most challenging place that I've done recording, because it's always windy. Doesn't matter where you go, it's always windy. Binaural microphones are particularly wind sensitive, and with these clipping onto my glasses, it just became impossible. I was hiding behind buildings all the time trying to do recording. I have a set of binaural microphones now that go in the ear, but you can't monitor at the same time, because you'd get feedback, right, if you put your headphones on top of that. You can monitor at the same time if they're not in your ears, but it's ideal if they're in your ears. Now, one thing I've discovered is with this hairstyle, if I put binaural microphones, I have I have this wind protection right here. I cannot change my hairstyle now. So because I've found I've done recordings outside with these binaurals, and, you know, I don't get any wind. So it's really great. There's also a difference with using that kind of binaural microphone, because people don't understand that it's a microphone. So there's an ethical question about people not realizing that you're recording. I don't use private conversations that I've recorded in urban places. I don't ever use those in my work, except with one exception. But I'll talk about that this afternoon during the panel. Yes, so the in-ear microphones, really good, very high quality, like very little noise from those microphones, which is great. I sometimes use a stereo microphone if I do want to be very obvious about what I'm doing, so just so that people can see and decide for themselves how close they want to be to the recording source. So I think I'll move now to the next role that I'm thinking about, which is a geographic role, basically taking people on a journey. And I have two examples that I'll show. One is a one-minute piece that I recorded 2 years ago, and I'll just play that. So that piece was just on a section of beach in the Gaspé, and in that 60 seconds, I wanted to give people a sense of the different parts of the beach. So the water coming over the cliff down onto the beach, the boat tourist boats that were always passing on the water, and then the actual texture of the beach, which is what I ended with, the sound of the tiny rocks that were on that beach. A much longer journey is this one, which is based on traveling by train from Montreal to Winnipeg. So I start off with a typical kind of establishing shot. You can hear the sound of the train. But then it comes in a bit closer when you realize that I'm trying to be quiet because it's just after midnight. And then so that's kind of like the establishing shot. And then later on in the piece here,
look out. It's about minus 20 degrees and we're about an hour and a half late.
So there I'm moving from more of a kind of medium distance where as we came into each station, I would say the temperature and whether we were on time or not, which became kind of an obsession of people on the train. And then I move in really close to the wheels and the engine of the train to give just a sensation of the power of that engine. So in a piece like this, I did recording every hour, except for when I was sleeping, on the train for 4 days. And then I went through and selected sections of the recording to take the listener from Montreal to Toronto to, you know, each station that we passed along the way. And then also included sections on the train itself. And then I had a radio. And I was going through the AM and the FM dial on the radio once an hour as well. So that and I didn't realize when I started that, although I maybe should have done, that once we got up to the north of Superior, there was nothing on the radio. I was just getting snow all the way, or static all the way through the dial. And there was snow everywhere outside. It was in March, so it seemed like a real connection there between the radio and the landscape. The final role, and perhaps the most important role, I think, of soundscape on radio is a link to ecological issues. And so last year, I saw a film, a documentary film by Liz Miller called The Waterfront, which is about water privatization in Highland Park, Michigan, which was the birthplace of the auto industry. And people in that community were getting charged up to $10,000 for water bills and being unable to pay their houses would then be foreclosed. Their children could be taken away by children's services because they weren't providing water. And all of this, because the water was being privatized, it wasn't anything to do with how much people were actually using, because there were often leaks that happened to be on their property but were in the main water lines, and they were getting charged for that. So it was... I was really impressed by this documentary and very concerned about what it meant about the future of water use, and so I got permission from the filmmaker to they had had a remix contest for the music. At the end of the film, there's a blues song by Joe L. Carter, and so I had remixed that. I thought I've never done a remix before, and I thought it would be interesting to work with that piece. So I did, and then I decided that for the Out Front commission that I had this spring, I would also include, I would make a longer kind of remix using that musical piece, using clips from the dialogue of the documentary, and also many water recordings that I had made in different kinds of contexts during my Soundwalk recordings from the last 15 years or so. So I'm just going to play you a clip from that, indicating how I'm trying to find a balance in this piece, because voice is very important in this piece, and there's way more spoken word than there is in most of my pieces, which don't really have very many words at all. But I thought, I mean, first of all, the people's voices were so powerful talking about this issue. And secondly, I think the issue itself needed to be brought into the piece. But I didn't want the soundscape work to disappear behind all of the voices. So I was trying to find a balance between the two, and you can decide for yourselves whether I was successful.
Somebody give me a bucket. Let me go out here and see if I can get enough rainwater just to wash my face.
You lose your phone.
Can't you see I don't have where else to stay?
This forest is like liquid gold now.
Want some kind of justice here.
Water bills went up
60%. Mr. Waterman, Mr. Waterman, please don't turn my water off today.
This water issue is so profound. I had no idea that we would be engaged in this horrific fight to have water recognized as a human right.
So So that's just a short clip from that. And so just to summarize those different roles, there's an educational role, a historical role, narrative role, a geographic role, and an ecological role. I think that, and in all of those ways, soundscape is important on radio. And I think it's important to think about different perspectives. I often, when people think about soundscape, it's the kind of macro, macro or establishing shot, the environment in a kind of general way. But it's important to remember that if you really want to, bring out the narrative function of sounds, it's also important to think about medium shots that focus on a sound, but also include, as a medium shot in a film would do, also include some of the context surrounding that sound. So it's kind of brought in. It's not like, I think the thing that's important to remember is that it's not like recording a sound object at any point, whether it's far away or close up. You're not trying to isolate the sound. You're not trying to get rid of other sounds, because always the context with other sounds is interesting and worthwhile to think about. But you can draw in so that you're not as far away from the sound, so that you're a bit closer to it, and also including some of the context. And then if you get really close up and you're starting to get into the texture of the sound, then you can work with texture, emotion, and ambiguity in ways that can be helpful in the construction of a radio piece as well. So those are all of the things that I had to talk about in terms of words about my work. At this point, if you have more questions, we can talk about your questions. And I also thought I could play that piece about the Lachine Canal, where I include, it's partly in French and partly in English, and I'm including some interview sections with people who were living in the area over some time. So, yeah.
You mentioned the role of, the last role was ecology, and I was wondering if by that, you know, you played the piece about the water issues in Michigan, but do you mean that it's a better medium for working with environmental concerns as a content, or the ecology may be seen as a broader term about how we look at, you know, there's landscape and soundscape and looking how we hear the world as a whole. I guess I wasn't sure if that's because that's an interest of yours to do pieces about environmental concerns, or if you see that distinction, or if I'm misunderstanding.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that distinction. And the word sound ecology or acoustic ecology is used a lot. You know, so there's the World Forum for Acoustic Ecology. There's a Canadian Association for Sound Ecology, both of which I am a member of. And many people who work with environmental sounds will use the term sound ecology. Now, it's problematic, I think, from the beginning, because ecology is supposed to mean the whole environment. Sound ecology is already reducing it. It's reducing it to only sound. And then the questions start to become about the sound environment, and often very specifically about noise, and often even more than that, about valuing a kind of wilderness aesthetic, where anything urban is monstrous. And I mean, I'm becoming incredibly simplistic here, I think. So I feel like this is all very kind of dangerous territory. But it's something that really concerns me, thinking, okay, what does sound ecology mean? Does it what does it have to do with ecology? And if ecology is thinking about the oikos, the home, our home in the big sense, our home being this planet, can we reduce it to only thinking about sound? Or is there, do we really need to think about, are we thinking about, what kind of ecology are we thinking about? Are we thinking about deep ecology in the way that Arne Naess would talk about ecology? Are we thinking about social ecology the way Murray Bookchin would talk about ecology? And I think that anybody who professes to do sound ecology has to think about those questions. I certainly feel like I have to think about it. And I don't think it's enough to just talk about noise, because I think sound, it feels reductive to me for it to be just an issue about noise. And people have very different ideas about noise. I mean, my students living in Montreal love going out at night to really noisy environments because they feel very vibrant and full of life. And I also question the kind of assumption that the pre-industrial environment was pristine and quiet. Because we don't know. I mean, whenever you're dealing with the past, you're trying to recreate or reimagine something that's gone, and basing it on what you might know, but also what you might desire the past to have been, what you might desire now but isn't here. So it's based on nostalgia. So I just... I think it's important to think about changes in sound over time, and certainly in some areas the sound environment is becoming noisier, but I don't think that's across the board. But I don't think that should be the whole focus of what sound ecology is. And so I'm not sure whether that answers your question or not. Is that the kind of thing that you were asking about?
Maybe there is a distinction between the definition of ecology and sound ecology and environmental ecology. Maybe I wasn't able to frame the question, but I also wanted to know, is there a tendency to do acoustic ecology pieces that do end up advocating or kind of promoting sustainability in terms of like bringing up awareness about things that are changing. So I guess not to say, oh, it has to be political, but just do you feel like because that, you know, it's about where we are living here on the earth, that it also brings our awareness to this idea of, that is a larger movement now of green stuff.
Yeah. Yes, I do think that there are acoustic ecology pieces that lead people to think about sustainability. Yeah, certainly. I think that if there can be connections between sound ecology and other kinds of ecology, then that is definitely something that I would be looking to do. Any other questions? So maybe I'll play that piece. It's about 10 minutes long. So it's and it's based on the Lachine Canal recordings from 4 years. So basically, we had about 400 hours of recording. And then for the installation, we made those into kind of pieces using that ellipsis, what I call the ellipsis method of just taking short segments and cross-fading them. So we cut it down to about 70 minutes for the installation, and then I took those and cut that down to about 10 minutes.
Et ceux qui devaient de l'argent ne pouvaient pas payer, on leur a demandé de commencer à creuser.
Le commerce de la glace coïncide avec comment la fin d'une période, je dirais, d'âge. Parce qu'à partir de 1947-48, là, tout le monde qu'on a dans les spéciales.
bateau qui pourrait faire la
kind of go back and forth between soundwalk recordings that we were doing in contemporary times with working with some of the interviews and trying to not really recreate but to evoke the soundscape of 30 or 40 years ago. So all of those boat horns that you heard, for instance, would not be heard on the canal now. They were heard on the canal prior to 1959 when it closed. I included in this piece many of the present inhabitants of the area, including, you know, red-winged blackbirds, sparrows, swallows, cyclists, skaters, car traffic, train traffic, factories, and also, I have to admit that this is an idealized version, in that I was quite fascinated with ice sounds, the ice sounds of the St. Lawrence, and it's true that of the recording that we did, probably almost half of the recordings were in icy environments because they were during the winter, but I really focused at one point in the middle of the piece on some of these beautiful ice sounds because I found them beautiful. So I do admit to that. But I think that what I found really interesting about that project was working with the other listeners who had lived in the area for some time and who gave us so much information and were such enthusiastic members of the project. I mean, became quite involved. So I do recommend doing that kind of research if you're doing any soundscape work that has a historical dimension. It's a really great way to involve a larger community in. And you know, Greg Wagstaff, that I mentioned earlier with the project in Scotland, worked with residents of the two islands, Harris and Lewis, and really did some very substantial work to involve the community in different ways. So school children did soundscape work in the classroom. He did sound walks across the moors with people who knew the local flora and fauna. He did. He gave. The project had some money for recording equipment. He gave recording equipment to several people who went out for a year and did soundscape recording. And then they were given instruction on how to use the equipment, and then how to edit the work to make soundscape work that was later included on the CD that was made by that project. And I actually have the CD set in my other bag where I'm staying, so I can bring it tomorrow. Hopefully I'll remember, I'll give myself a note. And if you're interested in that project, I can show you the CD. Just find me tomorrow. So are there any final questions? We're getting close to noon, so we'll probably have to end soon, but is there anything else that people wanted to ask? Well, you know, other things may occur to you over the next couple of days. So if that is the case, then for sure get in touch with me. And maybe I'll just play one of these pieces to end off the session. Amandier à fleur double. Don de Thérèse et Gaston Renaud. Cerisier à grappe de Schubert. Don de Collège Sainte-Anne. the interesting questions that came up in my several years ago is that I was confronted with a soundscape that I couldn't record. I was snorkeling, and I didn't have a decent hydrophone, so I couldn't record the sounds of the underwater environment. And so what I attempted to do when I wanted to represent that experience was I tried to, with my voice, create something that would evoke the soundscape and the landscape underwater. So this is Swimming the Reef, and it's a mostly constructed soundscape. There's a recording of the environment above the water in that region, and then once you go underwater, it's using voice to evoke a place. It's 12 o'clock. Thank you for coming this morning.